I'm a firm believer that if you're not a part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And that has always driven a lot of what I do, no matter what it is in life. Essentially, I believe there's no innocent bystanders. So for me, I would say that I was ultimately driven towards sustainability because if I'm going to be creating a company, I won't be able to sleep at night knowing that I'm just another part of the problem contributing to the massive issue of filling landfills and creating endless amounts of waste.
Hey, it's Duff Dixon, and welcome to the Live Wide Awake podcast. Thank you for being one of our listeners in 88 countries around the world. Today, we're speaking with Brandi Dallas, the founder of waste-neutral sustainable fashion brand Sansfath, which was also a Vogue Innovation Prize finalist. Brandi used to work in the luxury industry as the former marketing manager for Tiffany's and Marina Bay Sands for the shops. Now, she decided that if she was going to work as hard as she was, it might as well be for herself. And she decided to be part of the solution to bring fashion, luxury, sustainability, and affordability all together in a modern minimalist label. In this episode, we talk about waste-neutral fashion, building a sustainable fashion brand from cradle to grave, the beauty and material science of bamboo, and so much more. Okay, it's time to live wide awake. Okay, Brandi, well, thank you for being on the Live Wide Awake podcast with us today. Really excited to understand and dive into your journey. So I'd love to start a little bit about your career in luxury and how you ended up starting a sustainable fashion brand.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me here. I am such a fan of Green is the New Black. You guys have been pioneering the sustainable fashion space, I believe, in Singapore, one of the first and early adopters here. So it's an absolute pleasure to be speaking to you today. Going back to my career, I essentially was a hardcore human rights activist and started my career in that space from the age of about 13. And so for me, my interest in sort of making a change and making a difference has always been bubbling from a very young age. But I always had a very strong passion for the fashion industry. And so when I graduated from university, I started my career with an internship at GQ and Vogue in India, in Bombay. And that sort of was the game changer for me because I loved every minute of it. And that ended up taking me to, I worked for a textiles integrated cotton textile factory in India for over a year. And from there, basically moved to Singapore to start my career in luxury. So for me, it's always been the same tangent of fashion and looking at the industry from all the different perspectives, working at the factory and really seeing the back end of how things are produced and the human element that's involved was really important. Now, at the time, there was definitely moments where I was like, what am I doing in rural Punjab working in a textiles factory? But now looking back, it all kind of makes sense. But yes, I moved to Singapore in 2014 to begin my career at Marina Bay Sands, managing the marketing for the luxury fashion brands at the shops. And it was amazing because I got to work with all of the major fashion brands. So I got to see how Italian companies in high-end fashion works and the French and the level of craftsmanship and how quality, beautifully made items of clothing and bags and everything that was incredible. And from there, joined Tiffany & Company and was managing the marketing for Singapore for, I think, a little over 2.5 years.
Yeah. What was it that took you to India in the first place? It seems so random.
Yes. So I moved to Northern India to Dharamshala, and I was volunteering for a human rights organization that was looking after Tibetan refugee children. I moved when I was about 17 years old to begin my work there, and it was an incredible experience, and I absolutely fell in love with everything India. And that began about 9 year stint in the country. Moved from Dharamsala to Delhi. Delhi was ultimately, I'd say, my home for most of that period. And yeah, eventually it led me to the fashion industry. But yeah, everything sort of started with living in the Himalayas.
That's so incredible. And what a beautiful experience to have had at such a young age as well. I can imagine that would have been really profound and life-changing. And so how did you go from then working at Tiffany's to deciding you wanted to launch your own sustainable fashion brand?
It was a few things. Number one, I was working harder than I could have ever possibly imagined. Working in luxury fashion is a massive commitment. And for me, it was a mixture of, well, if I'm going to be working this hard, I would love to be working towards something of my own. And I'd say the other part of it would be, I personally struggled to find clothing that fit my aesthetic. And at the time, and now it's evolved considerably, because this would have been probably about like 4 or 5 years ago, I was constantly just being bombarded by sustainable options that were printed, made from like linens and fabrics that did not translate into the current lifestyle that I had working in luxury fashion and needing like polished wardrobe essentials. So no matter where I looked, with the exception of Net Sustain, which also had like a massive price tag attached to it, I was constantly being driven back to the H&Ms and the Zaras and those players to find clothes. And it just, I didn't feel good about it. And I wanted to find an alternative. So I figured I'll create it.
That's amazing. And how was that journey for you? I mean, I was really impressed by the extent that your brand has gone, Sans Faf. And just, I would love for you to walk through that journey of, you know, what was it in the beginning that even wanted to make you do the sustainability piece? Like, you know, you'd come from luxury. There's not a lot of sustainability in luxury, I would say. So where did that drive come from? And then how was that journey to actually build a brand that is sustainable?
I'm a firm believer that if you're not a part of the solution, you're a part of the problem. And that has always driven a lot of what I do, no matter what it is in life. Essentially, I believe there's no innocent bystanders. So for me, I would say that I was ultimately driven towards sustainability because if I'm going to be creating a company, I won't be able to sleep at night knowing that I'm just another part of the problem contributing to the massive issue of filling landfills and creating endless amounts of waste. And so for me, I think that having integrity in what you do is so important. And so being able to enter the industry and start this business, I needed to know, A, that I can sleep well at night knowing that in my small way, I'm trying my best to make a difference and make an impact and be ultimately accountable for what my brand does and how it contributes to the world and the impact that it has on the planet.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really important. And I felt had the exact same thing. You know, when I first started with Green is New Black, I realized I was part of the problem and I wanted to be part of the solution. So I'm exactly the same language.
Yay.
And so what did you decide to focus on then? So you, Kate, had knew you wanted to be part of the solution and you started this brand. So then where did that take you?
When I started the brand, I wanted to focus on monochromatic black and white. When it came to black, I realized through my research that viscose has an incredible color fastness. So being able to obviously create designs that will not only wash incredibly well, feel incredible, but also hold their color was the priority. And the more that I researched viscose, the more I realized how negative it can impact the environment. So 30% of viscose in fashion is actually sourced from endangered forests like the Amazon, illegally sourced. So the more I looked at it, I realized that wood-based viscose was not the answer and not something I wanted to get involved with. And then realized that bamboo viscose was an amazing alternative. Bamboo is one of the fastest growing plants in the world. I can talk about bamboo all day long because I wear it religiously. It feels good on your skin. It breathes incredibly. It's ultra soft. It grows organically. And I think that it stepped up as an amazing alternative to wood-based viscose.
Yeah. And yeah, I've had the pleasure of feeling some of the incredible fabrics that you have, and they really are so luxe, so soft, so breathable. I think it's really exciting to have such a luxurious looking and feeling brand, but one that is made with a very, very sustainable fabric. So I think this is a very exciting time for fashion that we're starting to see brands like yours emerge that really are, you know, rejecting a lot of what people might think when they think about sustainable fashion. And so would love to hear a little bit more about other things that you've sort of, you know, prioritized, because I think the certification, it's a minefield. So how did you navigate through that? And what did you actually prioritize? And why was that important to you to also have these certifications?
So one of the practices that I've used with my brand is always looking at who is setting the bar for best in practice in terms of whatever it is that I'm looking at when I build the business. And so there's a few major bamboo, sustainable bamboo players out in the market. And the more I research, the more I realize that what sets companies apart, especially when it comes to using bamboo-based fabrics, our fabric certifications. And so for me, we started with the FSC certification, which makes sure that no beautiful forests are cleared in order to make bamboo cash crops. So we know that it's sustainably grown bamboo. The other one is our Okotek certification. So no harmful chemicals are used in terms of wearing, creating our fabrics. That for me is a good one, especially because a lot of baby clothes are made with Okotek certification. So I love that our clothes are created at that level. I think that as a new mother, relatively new, I guess, if it's safe for my baby to wear, I think that's the ultimate gold standard. So feel good about that. And then we also looked at how the bamboo is essentially grown. And the cool thing, another fun fact about bamboo, is that it grows off of rainwater and it doesn't require boatloads of irrigation like cotton. And it doesn't require any pesticides because it's naturally antimicrobial. So I think that for us, looking at how best we can legitimize and be held accountable for how we source, how we grow, and how we produce what we make, that's ultimately, I think, what we had in mind.
Yeah. No, I think it's amazing. And I love the extent that you've gone. And also just how you communicated on your website. I think it's really transparent. And it actually answers all the questions that you might have, which I think is quite rare. Because I read a lot of websites before, you know, as I'm researching brands and everything. And I feel like there's always a lot to be desired in their comms. Yeah. And just, I always end up with more questions. And I have to message them on Instagram to be like, I don't understand this. Or this is a huge part missing. Like, where is it made? And how is it made? And blah, blah, blah. So I think you've actually done that really well. And so I'm curious, like, do you get a lot of common questions about sustainable fashion or any myths that you, or even just, you know, bamboo as a fabric that you would want to address? Like, do you find that people are constantly asking the same things, or you've had to convince them that, you know, anything about sustainable fashion or bamboo?
So this is a fun thing that I learned, is that the cotton lobbyists in the US have put out a lot of misinformation with regards to bamboo because it serves as a major competitor to the cotton industry. So I would say some not so positive sort of commentary on bamboo sometimes with regards to the fact that it's created into a pulp to make the viscose. And there is a chemical, I'd say, process in doing so. But ultimately, the basis of what you are creating comes from bamboo fibers, and there's no way to work around that. So I think that there are some questions that come up for sure, but it's through our certifications that we're able to clarify and just educate people on the fact that the stories that are coming out from these really interesting, really big major conglomerates in the US are not necessarily supported by that much data. And yeah, I think that as someone who's, you know, seen bamboo and how it grows and where it grows and all that sort of stuff, very confident in the fact that it is an extremely positive addition to, I think, what's being offered in the industry and as an amazing alternative for people in comparison to some of the water pesticide eating alternatives that are out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I know, you know, obviously cotton is a natural fiber, but yeah. I think a lot of people don't realize the amount of water it takes to produce, you know, a single cotton t-shirt. It's like 7,000 or 3,000 liters, which is enough, you know, water that we would consume in like a 3-year period if we were drinking. So when you understand that, and then just even the water capacity, and then, as you said, chemicals and pesticides and all these things, like cotton is a very thirsty crop.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right. You know, bamboo, and we need these more innovative fibers that are natural and regenerative and, you know, all the great things about it. And hopefully we can start to navigate more through that misinformation, because I think that is a really confusing part for a lot of consumers. And so I'd love for you to maybe share, as a consumer, when we're looking at sustainable brands, how can we tell if they're actually being authentic or if they're greenwashing? Because I think this is something that so many of us struggle with.
Yeah. So I think that it becomes quite obvious if you log into a brand's website and they have all sorts of beautifully, powerfully written commitments about how they care for the environment. If they are lofty promises without any sort of measurement or any sort of proof, if it's just not there, then I would say the proof is in the pudding. Because as you mentioned, for us, it was like, we want our customers to be able to know exactly what we're doing and how we are taking accountability for our footprint. So it goes into, if you can see the steps that a company is taking very transparently with regards to what they are doing in order to prevent waste, for example, or how they choose their fabrics and what those fabrics do at the end of their life or where do they go. For us, that's an important part of our story, because we like to be able to trace from like cradle to grave exactly the impact that we're having. And we openly talk about all the steps that we're taking to mitigate negative impacts, but also the areas where we want to improve, because we're by no means perfect. That is another amazing benchmark to look at, is also, what is the conversation looking like? Is it open and transparent? Are we talking about all the areas where a brand can improve in addition to all the areas where they're doing it right? Because if a brand's just, you know, making lofty promises about how much they care but have no evidence to back it up, I think that says a lot, and you get your answers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd love to talk a little bit about what you just mentioned about the waste offsetting and how you're neutralizing that. I think this is a super interesting part that I enjoyed reading about, and the partnership with NewCycle.
Yeah. So it was really interesting when I started the brand, you know, we were looking at biodegradable fabrics. Another plus to bamboo is that it does biodegrade within a year if it's properly disposed of. And then, you know, from the fabrics and also looking at our packaging, we were using recycled materials, biodegradable materials, zero plastic, all those sort of things we took into consideration and made sure that we were, you know, taking full accountability of the end of life for our products. But I realized about a year into launching Somfaf that essentially 13% of domestic waste in Singapore is ultimately recycled. And Singapore incinerates 40% of its garbage. So knowing how the ecosystem and the infrastructure here operates, I realized that even though our products are biodegradable and our packaging is recyclable and biodegradable, if it's ultimately ending up in an incinerator. It doesn't really quite matter ultimately for this market what we're doing in this space. So taking all of that into consideration, I met with the New Cycle team, who are amazing, and basically told them what my issue was. And we realized that in order to take full accountability for the life cycle of our products, we need to look at waste offsetting, especially given how things operate in Singapore. So New Cycle is incredible because they measure our total waste that we create each year from the pens that we use in our office. Yeah, to our fabric, to our hang tags, to the boxes. Everything is measured by weight. And we essentially take out the exact same weight of waste from the natural environment. Specifically in Lombok, there's a waste conversion partner that we work with. And it's an incredible technology that essentially they have a plant that takes all of the worst plastics that you could possibly imagine, all the most undesirable, toxic plastic, and they actually convert it into viable petrol that's used to fuel generators and motorcycles on the island. So for us, you know, being able to say, all right, you know, we're coming clean because yes, we have waste. We're going to take for granted that most of our products, when they reach the end of their life cycle, may be incinerated. But in order to make up for that, we're going to take out the exact same equivalent of that weight from the natural environment and turn it into something else. So for me, that's really exciting. And learning about the technology that's out there that like enables this amazing conversion is very exciting. And then also being able to just take accountability for that as well is something that, again, makes me sleep better at night.
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine. And what a fantastic program. And I think it's so exciting that, you know, you're able to offset in that way and then have this beautiful story of really undesirable plastic waste actually having a extended life and, you know, being in some way in a closed loop there. So I think that that's great. But I do also, you know, there's a lot of people who, when they hear the word offsetting, they're instantly skeptical or, you know, just because of everything that's been happening in the carbon offsetting space and the lack of transparency that's there, the, you know, double counting and all the other things that have come to light. I think it's quite murky. And so has this been an issue for you to address this or like, you know, because it is still using that offsetting word?
Right. So I think that for me, I naturally gravitated towards waste offsetting because it's a very tangible like-for-like process. Whereas with carbon offsetting, it's so intangible to me. And no matter, I've tried to research it, I've tried to dig deeper into it, and I quite frankly just don't understand how it works, how it's tracked, how it's monitored. So for me, I completely shy away from it. I would love for someone to help make me understand how it works. But I think that for that very reason, it's exactly why I've never gone into that space. And I love the fact that with waste offsetting, you are literally taking the equivalent of what you're producing and removing it from the natural environment. So it's clear, it's easy to understand. And I think that at the end of the day, it's a positive step. And there's no way to deny that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's wonderful. And that's a really clear delineation between the two, because it is so confusing with carbon offsets. But this, as you said, very tangible, very transparent. So yeah, I think that's really interesting. And so what do you hope to see for the fashion industry in the next 5 to 10 years? Obviously, you've come from luxury, you've deep dove into sustainable fashion, you've really gone above and beyond to, you know, close the loop on your waste, on your fabrics, like all these types of things. But what do you actually think we might be seeing in general? Because I think the fashion industry is very good at keeping the status quo. It's very unethical in general. You know, there's so much waste, too much consumption, too much production. Do you think we're going to see a change?
I absolutely think that we will see a change. I think that government regulation is going to be the cornerstone of that change. And we've already seen it take effect. So in January 2023, we've seen France really up its ante in terms of government intervention and regulation in the space. Well, I believe the anti-waste and circular economy law, which is what they ultimately implemented in January 2023 this year, is just the beginning and the tip of the iceberg. And I think it's incredible that one of the biggest contributors to luxury fashion is making this step. And I think it's just going to be a matter of time until other countries fall in line as well. And the steps that they're taking as well are demanding transparency. They're demanding that the end of greenwashing ultimately. So I think that with government intervention and creating policies that ultimately hold brands and consumers accountable, that will be the ultimate change that we need. And I think that we've seen this in other industries like big tobacco. This is something that I recently read and it resonated so deeply with me because if we look at the tobacco industry as early as the 1960s, we already knew that tobacco and smoking caused cancer. And for the longest time, the governments and the companies said, okay, yeah, this is happening. And it didn't affect consumers at all. People still bought cigarettes and still smoked. It was still super cheap, super approachable, affordable, and marketed as the ultimate sexy thing to do. And in some cases, people were even sold that it was healthy and good for you. And there's a lot of similarities between, I think, big tobacco and fast fashion. And it ultimately took the government to intervene, to have warning labels, and for the prices to change to convince the public that this isn't necessarily the best thing for you to be consuming. And I think that we're going to see a big shift in the way that fashion is produced and consumed when we see government intervention. Because up until now, it's been left to the consumer to make the decision. And as we've seen with big tobacco, it doesn't work. It ultimately needs to come down to the government for prices, I think, to change. I was reading a stat and it was something like, Shein's prices or Sheen's prices were the equivalent of what it was to buy a pack of cigarettes in the 60s.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So there's a direct similarity in terms of fast fashion and smoking. And we're seeing it play out, obviously, in a different sphere, but it's almost the same effect. So I'm really excited for all of the government regulations that are going to churn out, I think, in the next 5 to 10 years. And we already see that happening with France's recent legislation, which is super exciting. So I think we're at the tip of the iceberg and it's only going to get better from here.
Good. I hope so. It's about time. So how do you think that we can live wide awake?
I think that we can live wide awake by being fully accountable for what we produce and what we consume as people on this planet. And by really investing in timeless fashion pieces, investing in quality people and things and experiences, and really looking at the end of the day what your impact is on the planet and what sort of difference you're making, even on the smallest level of when you buy a t-shirt, what does that mean? And what sort of impact are you making? And how is this affecting or contributing to the world, this moment, this space? I think living wide awake is just ultimately being conscious and considerate in everything that you do.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Randy, for joining us and for sharing such interesting information and everything. So yeah, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute joy to be here. And yeah, thank you.
Three things I'm taking away from this conversation with Randy. Firstly, if you're not part of the solution, then you are part of the problem. Secondly, government regulation is the cornerstone of change required. We saw it with big tobacco, and now is the time for fast fashion. And thirdly, bamboo is an incredible fabric, a renewable resource, breathable, grown organically, biodegradable, antibacterial, and ultra soft. So I guess we should all be looking more for bamboo. I'm I'm curious, what did you think about the episode and what were your main takeaways? Is there a topic you want me to dive deeper into? I'd love to hear from you. You can find me at Steffel Dixon or at Live Wide Awake. If you got something out of the podcast and you want to continue this journey with us, consider subscribing and supporting. I hope that today's conversation stirred something deep within you, ready to awaken. And until next time, live wide awake.